Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Marcelo Gleiser here from Dartmouth College, where I went to school. I actually met him 20 years ago to discuss some ideas in his office. And now, you know, just a few months ago, I got a letter from his publisher out of the blue saying his book was coming and he was coming to San Francisco. And was I at all interested? So of course I'm interested, especially because I followed his work over time. And I would like to say about this book, The Islands of Knowledge, you know, a lot of people know me from the Monday Night Philosophy series. They have been, you know, that I'm very interested in the assumptions that people make when trying to understand something. And very rarely in physics does somebody make the assumption that Professor Gleiser has made, and it has made his explanations of what we know and what we don't know so much clearer. And that assumption is very simple, and that is it's the scientific approach to things, which is we know what we know and we don't know what we don't know, and we're all in this together trying to figure it out rather than trying to demonstrate that something that somebody else believed 50 or 100 years ago. Science doesn't try to prove what somebody believed 2,000 years ago anymore. But, you know, 50, 100 years, it's always an attempt to try to make that idea work rather than look for the new paradigm or a new idea that could maybe clarify that or at least be aware that that's a possibility. And so his explanations of where we are, best I've read in a very long time. So, Professor Marcelo Gleiser.
Thanks. Thanks for the invitation, George, and thanks for taking the time in the middle of the day to come here. And I know that some of you have to probably go back to work at around 1, so I'll make sure that I don't go over time. So, as George said, I want to talk about knowledge and what do we even mean by that? And in particular, about how science constructs our knowledge of reality, right? So the real topics of what I want to talk about are sort of grand, you know, what is reality? And reality is a real loaded word that represents different things to different people. And part of that is also related to what is truth. And I was walking up the stairs and I realized that the purpose of the club is to discuss the nature of truth. So this is right on, you know, and I'm very happy to be here. So to set the stage, apart from that beautiful island over there, and some of you guys are going to have your neck kind of turned because I'll be using that, I want to start with a quote from Einstein, okay, which I think is very beautiful. And basically what he's saying is that what we know of nature is a magnificent, I don't have my glasses on right now, is a magnificent structure that we can only know imperfectly, right? And that must fill a thinking person with a feeling of humility. Now, that's very, very important because Einstein, for those of you who don't know him very well, was a scientist that believed that the human mind could penetrate the secrets of nature, right? He was a true believer in the power of reason and, furthermore, on the power of order, that nature had to be comprehensible. It couldn't be sort of crazy, bottom down, right? So he was the one that said, for example, that God doesn't play dice, right? Which what he meant by that was that there has to be law. There has to be a law that explains how the ultimate reality works. And we humans, with our minds, should be able to tap into that, right? If you're smart enough, like he was, obviously. And yet, he also realized that there was a limit to what we could know, that we are limited beings. We're real smart, we're awesome, etc., but there's only so much we can understand of the world. And that's what he meant by a feeling of humility, which a lot of my colleagues in academia lack very sorely, in the sense that, you know, they don't admit to themselves that, you know what, we know a lot, but we really know very little of what's truly going on. And the talk that I'm going to give is very much based on this notion that, you know, we know much less than we think we do know, which doesn't make science less wonderful. And that's a very important point. So to put things in context, I want to give you another one of Einstein's quotes, which is actually my favorite, okay? It says, "The fairest thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true art and science. He who does not know it and can no longer wonder is as good as dead. Now, that is, I think, a call to arms. Like, he's basically saying, people, wake up. Nature is spectacular. It's mysterious. And it's calling us to try to understand it, right? And it's this connection with the unknown, with what we do not know of reality, right? This what he calls the mysterious, which is really the key behind our creativity, right? So we humans have this urge to understand more and more. Even if on our everyday lives we don't like stop, you know, in the middle of Market Street and say, I wonder how the universe started. You know, it's this Big Bang. What the heck does that talk? You know, you don't do that. Sometime in your lives you will, or you have, right? And sometimes you're going to look up at the sky when it's not foggy in San Francisco, and you're going to see the stars, and you're going to say, wow, what are these things up there? You know, are they just like our sun? Are there planets around those stars? Are these planets inhabited with people, with creatures? So those questions, right, that we, everybody has asked, has been, those questions have been with us since the beginning of time, right? So they're not modern questions. People have asked these questions and wondered about the universe and about creation since the beginning. And that's why many religions, they start with these pronouncements, you know, about this is how the world began. So we are familiar here, right, with the Old Testament. It starts with the beginning of the world and it ends with the end of the world. So it has a whole historical dramatic arc, right? Here's the beginning and this is the end, and everything that happens in the middle is our history, so to speak. And many different religions are doing similar things. You know, they are coming up with terms to explain, or at least to kind of contextualize how we understand the world and how we don't understand the world, you know, the mystery of what we do not know. So, and you see that little fish there, right? And the fish there is a wonderful representation of us, okay? Because we look at the fish and say, wow, the fish, poor fish, right? I mean, he is inside the bowl and his world is really limited. You know, he sort of can glimpse through the glass that there's something out there, but he can't really grasp it, right? And of course, you don't want to be the fish. You want to be the photographer outside, right? Hey, look at that. It's beautiful. It's a fish by the beach, and there is the sunset. There is all this rich reality out there that I can comprehend and I can grasp, right, with my mind. And poor fish, he's so limited. And turns out, people, that we are very much like that fish, right? And that what we see of reality is a glimpse of what's really out there. Right, and I can give you a few examples. Right, so let's think about this for a second. We know reality from what? Well, from our senses. Right, you can see me, you can hear me, you can feel the heat, you can touch the chairs. So say, yep, you know, my brain has these sensors, right? The organs, the eyes, the ears, etc. And they are sort of like little antennas. Right, they look out into the world. They gather information. This information goes into our heads, it's integrated by the brain, and then you say, yep, this is reality, right? And it turns out that, well, that's really a tiny little bit of reality, right? That there is this whole invisible stuff out there. There is not less real just because we don't perceive it. It's just there. And there is this beautiful line in The Little Prince where the fox is talking to the little prince, and the fox says, what is essential is invisible to the eye. And in many ways, science deals with this invisible to the eye, right? Of course, there is the science of the immediate that we see, etc., but it's the science of the invisible, the science that basically opens windows to what we cannot see with our senses. That is really what we're doing now, right? And what we have been doing for some time. And right now, I like to say that, you know, we have all the AM and FM stations beaming waves through this room, right? You are all glowing in the infrared, but we don't see that, right? There is like a lot of ultraviolet light in these white lights over there. We don't see that either. But that doesn't mean that they're not there. We don't see it because we're humans, and humans evolved in a planet that lives close to a star. which has a surface temperature of about 6,000 Celsius, which is something like 12,000 Fahrenheit or so. And it beams most of its radiation in what we call the visible, which is just the beams of light between, you know, the indigo blue, the violet, and the red. And so our eyes evolved in this planet to maximize what it could capture. So it would be really useless for us to see things in the ultraviolet or the infrared or in X-rays, because basically we'd be eaten by tigers all the time, right? So you had to really see stuff in order to survive. And so there's an evolutionary reason for us to see things this way, right? Which is a very important point to remember, right? Well, let me quote two different people about what we mean here. The first one is Werner Heisenberg, and all of you quantum physics enthusiasts remember Heisenberg and his uncertainty principle. Those of you that don't, just think that Heisenberg was one of the key minds in developing quantum physics, which is the physics that studies the world of the very small, the world of atoms and molecules and subatomic particles, right? And it turns out that about 30% of the gross domestic product of the U.S. right now comes from quantum physics. So it's something that actually right nearby in Silicon Valley, people take very seriously, right? So all your iPhones and iPads and GPSs rely very heavily on what we have learned in quantum physics. It's good to keep in mind, though, that the whole quantum revolution came about because a bunch of white European guys in the early 1920s wanted to figure out how the atom worked. They had no idea that the knowledge of atomic physics would lead to this profound revolution, not just in how we perceive reality, but how we live our lives, right? I mean, it's obvious to all of us here. So, yet, what Heisenberg says is very important, because he's saying that what we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. What does that mean? It means that you cannot separate the way we look at nature from the way we are and the way we think. Basically, what he's saying here is there is no absolute knowledge. There is human knowledge. There is the way we understand the world. And that is related to truth and the nature of truth. You know, so when people talk about absolute truth, you have to be very, very careful what you mean by that, right? From a scientific perspective, there are things we know, like, you know, I know that here on Earth, if I hammer this thing here, it's going to make a certain sound that is going to propagate with a certain speed. Yeah, but these truths are sort of irrelevant. You know, they're just scientific facts that we collect. When I'm talking about more fundamental truths, like what is space, what is time, what is energy, how did the universe begin, what is the structure of matter, what is consciousness, those questions, which are much more complicated questions, do not have a final answer. And that's sort of one of the things I want to talk about. And the reason for that is summarized beautifully by this philosopher from the 17th century called Bernard Le Bouvier de Fontenelle. In 1686, he wrote a book, which is actually the same year that Newton published his super book, right, the Principia, where he talked about the laws of motion and the law of gravity. That book changed the world completely, right? In that same year, this philosopher from France published this book where he speculates about life in other planets. So it's called something like A Conversation on the Plurality of Worlds. And the cool thing about this book is that it was a dialogue, sort of inspired by Plato and his dialogue, between the philosopher and a woman, a marquise. So, and this is very unusual. This is 17th century. The woman is a protagonist, right? She's really smart. She has this killer intuition. And she's always trapping the philosopher in his arguments. And that's a very unusual structure for a book in the 17th century. But what he says, and he's interested in the nature of knowledge as well, he says this: all philosophy is based on two things only, curiosity and poor eyesight. And that is just brilliant, right? Because that's exactly it. Why? We humans are curious, right? We want to know everything. We want to know more, right? So, and a lot of the modern technologies that we have is like gather information. What does that mean? Well, you want knowledge, right? You want information. But we are myopic. We cannot see everything, right? So clearly, if you base what you know of reality in your senses, as I was just talking about, you know that that's going to be very limited, right? Because there is much more to reality than what we can capture with our eyes and ears, etc., right? And from this tension of wanting to know and not being able to know comes all this creative urge that we have to expand our boundaries as creatures, right? We want to know more and more, so we find ways of knowing more and more. How? Well, you build telescopes and microscopes, right? You build instruments that can amplify your antennas to understand reality more. And then you say, okay, but what reality is this? So going back to Plato, right? So 400 years, more or less, BCE, Plato wrote a book called The Republic, and which is basically in The Republic, it's a dialogue where he wants to construct a pedagogy to train the best possible leader, right? So is becoming, the name was the philosopher king, right? So he has a whole plan to do that. Now, as part of the plan, he talks about the nature of reality and how it fools us. And he has this thing called the allegory of the cave, right? So the allegory of the cave, it's a brilliant exercise in showing us how we are limited in our perception of the world, right? So here it goes. Let's imagine that we are in a cave, which is kind of a good approximation to where we are right here, right? And that you are all slaves. Sorry, that's Plato, not me, right? You're all slaves, and you had a pretty miserable life because since you've been born, you've been chained and forced to look only forward. So you can only look in forward direction towards the wall of the cave, okay? So all you can see of the world, you can't turn this way, you can't turn this way, you cannot turn back. All you can see of the world is what is projected on the cave wall, sort of like in a movie theater, right? And those slaves don't know that behind them, there's this huge fire, and there are a bunch of philosophers with little statues and objects. And what they're doing is that, you know, they're putting the statues and objects in front of the fire, and the shadows are being projected on the wall and being animated. And they say, yeah, that's the world. Look, this is happening or that's happening. And they have no clue that their view of the world is profoundly limited, right? So here's a cartoon where Neo from The Matrix, I think you don't know. If you don't know The Matrix, you know, this very famous sci-fi movie where humans are actually trapped into believing they're free, like that this is reality, when in fact they're all inside little cylinders with their perception of reality beamed to their heads directly into their brains. So, you know, the eyes capture the sights, right? But if you go straight to the optical nerve and bypass the eye and you know how to signal whatever is being transmitted by the optical nerve, you can see, in quotes, without seeing, right? So you could bypass the organs and just go straight into your head. So the idea of the Matrix is that we really are not free. We are stuck in there, but we believe we are free because all this reality is being beamed directly into our heads, right? And there comes Neo, Keanu Reeves, to save the world, right? That's essentially the idea. So now Neo is visiting Plato's cave, and there he goes. So here's Neo with his machine gun, right? And you can see the slaves, and they're looking at a unicorn that is doing something that he shouldn't be doing in public. I think he's basically pooping, right? And Neo is there, and he's saying, you know, the prophecy says that one day the Savior is going to come and reveal to us the true nature of reality. No way, right? It's not happening. And you can see behind the fire, roaring fire, and the philosopher making little finger figures, right? So the unicorn is not really there. It's just a trick. But yet the slaves, that's all they see. And they say, ha, they're unicorns. They exist. And they poop just like we do. That's amazing, you know? So we know more about reality now because of that. And it's all fake. So the question is, who are we? Are we the philosophers or are we the slaves? And it turns out that we are the slaves, right? That, yes, we have these antennas, we see a lot of the world, but we see much less than it's truly out there, right? And that's a very important thing. So let me try to contextualize that into three different parts. Okay, I'll talk about three different realities that we construct: the universe or the cosmic reality, the material, you know, the stuff that, that things are made of, and the cognitive, like the brain. Okay, so let's start with the cosmic. First, remember that the way we amplify our vision of the world is through our instruments, right? So these are what I call reality amplifiers. And it is really amazing what a difference in the way we look at the world an instrument can make. So just to give you an example outside physics so that you don't think I'm always biased, the microscope and biology, right? So the microscope was invented in the late 1600s. And the 17th century was really something else, if you start to think about it. I mean, a lot of very important things happened in the 17th century, and including the microscope and the telescope. But so the microscope was invented, and it completely changed the way people thought about life. Because before the microscope, life was just the creatures you could see. Oh, there goes the dog or the flea. But that was it, right? And suddenly, with the microscope, you would look at a drop of water, right? And you see all these little creatures that exist and are alive and are moving and eating one another, making us sick, people figure out later, right? And we don't see them, right? And so they became part of reality. So your view of reality was deeply enlarged by an instrument that did that, right? And our view of what life is was transformed as a consequence of that. And many, many instances in the history of science, in the history of how we understand the world, the same thing happened. The telescope is a very important discovery that did exactly the same. It transformed the way we looked at ourselves within the cosmos, which I'll talk about in a second, and what is our place in the cosmos as well, and has produced several different revolutions in our worldview in the last 400 years, right? And I have two other machines that are really important. You know, on the bottom left, that is the Hubble Space Telescope, which is one of the most amazing machines ever built. Just pause to understand how awesome science is. So here you have a machine which is a robot. It's a telescope, but it's really a robot, right? Because it's a machine that is in orbit, really far away from here. That has this very powerful telescope that is being operated by scientists on Earth by remote control. Now, you know, you see sometimes kids playing with a car, remote control, you know, and they hit the table and whatever. And imagine operating a machine that precise so far away from here. And it works. And not just it works, it transformed the way we see the universe. That is really awesome, with the right use of the word awesome. Right, and on the right-hand side is the heart of the ATLAS detector. The ATLAS detector is where the Higgs particle, the so-called God particle, was discovered. Right, so that thing is about four-story high. Machine has more steel there than the Eiffel Tower. Right, I don't know if you can see because of the size of the screen, but there is a little person there, right in the bottom, in the middle there. It's a huge thing, and that also transformed the way we look at what the world is made of, right? So these machines are extremely important to that. So let's talk about cosmic reality. And let me show you how our perception of what is real and what we call the universe changed in time in such profound ways. So let's go back to, say, 1492. Columbus arrived, not quite to America, but kind of around here, right? What universe did he and everybody else in Europe live in, right? Well, it was an Earth-centered universe. The Earth was the center of everything. It didn't move. It was surrounded by a bunch of planets that were stuck to crystal spheres. So, and the crystal spheres would revolve, and as they revolved, they would take the planets with them, sort of like a cosmic onion, right? It's just sliced. You have ones like the Russian dolls, one inside another. The Earth was the center. At the very periphery was this so-called sphere of the stars, and outside of that was the realm of God and the angels, right? So that was the structure of the universe around 1500. That had been the structure of the universe for about 2,000 years or so, right? I mean, without the God and the angels on the outside, Aristotle, this is the Aristotelian universe. Aristotle didn't put God and angels, but he did put something called the prime mover, which was kind of like a God that imparted the motion from the outside in. You know, he had to figure out, look, if everything is moving, the planets are moving, where's this motion coming from, right? It's a big, complicated question. He said, well, there was this being outside everything, which was the prime mover that could move without being moved. Okay, thanks. You know, that explained everything, right? So, and then that thing became God with the Christian theology later on. But the point here is that that was the universe people believed in, and that was reflected on their theology, the way they believed, right? And even in their architecture, because when you go and you look at a medieval cathedral, what do you see? You see a very vertical construction, right? And the reason for that is that it wants to force you to look up. Why? So you can commune with God up in the skies, right? So there's this very, and why is that? Well, because if you look at their world, the earth was in the center, God was all the way up there. So your goal was to go up. You had to ascend in grace to heaven. And so the structure of the universe was reflected in people's beliefs and in the architecture of the temples of the time, right? So it was a very deep connection between, hey, this is the universe I live in, and this is who I am and what I'm supposed to be doing here on Earth, right? And then comes Copernicus in 1543, and he turns this upside down, right? So he says, sorry, folks, the Earth is not the center. It's actually moving around the sun. It's just another planet, you know? And that was offensive, right? Because, I mean, you go from the center being created by God to just being another planet, meaning what? Like Mars and Venus and Jupiter? Yep. Just like that. And in fact, it was found afterwards that Jupiter was much cooler because it had four moons. That was Galileo found, right? And nowadays, we know Jupiter has about 60, more than 60 moons. Now imagine what the night must be like in Jupiter. It must be just an awesome sight, right? And so Earth was kind of degraded, right, from the Earth, the center of everything, to just a planet moving around. And that turned people's understanding of who they were upside down, you know, because they didn't know who they were anymore. It was clashing with religion. And so the whole debacle between Galileo and the church, and which is a whole other talk that I could give, which I won't, came because people didn't know how to relate this new universe to their beliefs anymore. And in fact, the first guy who criticized Copernicus was Luther. Martin Luther was in the Catholic Church. It was Luther who says, you know, there's this astrologer from Poland who wants to turn the world upside down, saying that we're just moving around like in a merry-go-round. He's crazy, you know, because it's against Scripture. So it wasn't the Catholic Church came up much later with its criticism of the sun center world. But the point is that it took root, right, as we know, obviously, because it was the right way to think. And with Galileo and with Kepler and Descartes and Newton, all the guys from the 17th century again, right, who really transformed this view and says the sun is the center. And there are many kind of details that we don't have time to talk about. It's not quite the center, but because it's not a sphere. It's really an elliptical orbit, and so the sun is on a focus, but let's forget that. It was still the place, right, where light emanated from, right, which was sort of a beautiful image, right? And Kepler, who is one of my heroes, actually used that, say, of course God would put the center there because that's where light comes from. What would God do? You know, light is God. God has to spread the light through creation. So he had this astronomical reason for understanding the sun in the center, and a theological reason as well, right? So the whole thing was connected, right? Okay, cut to the 20th century, right? And we go to that bottom right picture there, which is so awesome that I repeat it in full here. Now, this picture is, I know I'm being biased saying this, but this picture is one of the most awesome pictures ever taken in history, okay? Now, what is this thing? Like, it looks like just a bunch of flashes and stuff like that, right? That thing is a picture taken by this Hubble Space Telescope called the Deep Field. So what they do is essentially they point the telescope in a very narrow direction, okay, for a very long time. And basically telescopes are buckets of light, right? They receive light, they collect all the light, and then they take a picture, right? So this is a very long exposure picture of a very narrow piece of sky. And what do you see that is gazillions of lights. Now, what are these lights? Well, this is what's really amazing. Each one of these dots, these big smudges, you can see they're like galaxies, right? Well, it turns out that every little dot there is a galaxy too, okay? And what the heck is a galaxy for you guys that don't remember from high school or college? Well, a galaxy is basically a big bundle of stars, which is basically, there are so many stars in there, it's a self-gravitating bundle of stars. So you could imagine that each one of you is a star, and this, you form a galaxy right now, okay? That's the idea. So we live in a galaxy, the Milky Way, as you know, and the sun is one star, right? Now, there are about 200 billion stars in the Milky Way alone. 200 billion, it's a ridiculous number. And now we know something that we didn't know 20 years ago. We suspected, but we didn't know, and now we know from observations that the vast majority of stars have planets moving about it. So the sun is not unique in that way. You know, the sun is one star that has eight planets. Now that Pluto has been, poor Pluto, right, has been kicked out, it's not a planet anymore. You know, which shows how science evolves, right? Oh, it's a planet. No, it's not a planet. Okay, there was a big debate and it was decided. So it's a human criterion for what is a planet and not a planet. It's not like a God-given truth. Very important, right? Anyways, so all these stars have planets. And remember I said that Jupiter has over 60 moons? Now you do the math, right? And you come up with numbers like, in the Milky Way alone, there are over one trillion worlds. And just like in our solar system, each planet is completely different from one another, each one of these worlds is going to be completely different as well, right? So the numbers are ridiculous, it's staggering, right? And then you say, oh, what about that picture? Uh-huh. That picture says that those guys are just like the Milky Way, each one of them. There are about 200 billion galaxies in the universe, okay? And what are the distances there, right? Well, the distances there are of millions of light years between these galaxies. Let me pause for a second to talk about light and distance, because that's really interesting. So, you know, light is the fastest thing that we know, right? It travels at 186,000 miles in 1 second, which is another ridiculous number. You know, what does that even mean? It means this. If you blink your eye, light goes 7.5 times around the Earth. Okay, boop, 7.5 times. That's as close to conceivable as I can imagine, right? I mean, and it basically means that for light to go from here to the moon, it takes about 1.2 seconds. Okay, and for light to go from the sun to us, well, we're getting all this light from the sun, it takes about 8 minutes. Okay, so that means that if the sun exploded right now, we would only know in 8 minutes. And it would be the last thing you would ever know, right? Because, boom, the sun exploded, finished, the end of the world. But the point is that information coming from these places are taking time to get to us, right? So when you look at pictures like that, you say, okay, where is the nearest? Clearly, is the Milky Way in that picture? Quiz. It couldn't be, right? Because in order to take a picture of the Milky Way, you have to get out of it. And we can't even get to Mars. So it'll be a long way before that happens. But just to give you an idea, the Milky Way in diameter from edge to edge is about 100,000 light years. That means that if you turn on a flashlight in one end, it will take 100,000 years to get to the other end, okay, the light, traveling at that speed. So it's really damn big, right? And then you look at these, and our neighboring galaxy is Andromeda, which is a huge galaxy. That is going to eat us in about 4 billion years, more or less. It's going to be a galactic collision, which is not like a car collision. It's a little more fluid and sort of transparent, you know, because stars are so far from one another. But still, it's going to be bad, but we won't be here. You don't have to worry about your insurance policy for that one. So Andromeda is about 2 million light years from us. That means that when an astronomer is looking at Andromeda, he's not looking at it as it is now. Is looking as it were, 2 million years ago. So when you look at the sky, you're really looking at a time machine to the past, right? And the deeper you go in, the farther away the object is, the more into the past you go. So the obvious question is, how far can we go? Well, we know the answer. which is a wonderful thing. We actually know that the universe has an age. The universe was born, just like we were born. Don't ask me exactly how, or you can ask me later, I can talk to you about that. But it appeared, it emerged 13.8 billion years ago. So 14 billion years ago. In cosmology, we don't really care about 100 million years that much. You know, that's 100 million years. But that tells you something. If light can only travel at a finite speed, and the universe has a finite age, in the age of the universe, light could only have gone so far, right? And since everything that we gather from the universe is in form of different kinds of light, you know, visible light, that picture is obviously invisible, you could take the same kind of picture using the infrared that the stars are emitting, or the ultraviolet, or the X-rays if it has a violent event. Basically, all of these are different kinds of lights, so to speak, and they all travel at the same speed, which basically tells you that you can only see the universe up to a certain point, right? And that means that we are very much like that fish in the bowl. We live in a bubble of information, of light. And we cannot go beyond that because in 14 billion years, light could not have traveled that far. Now, does that mean that the universe ends right there? I mean, it's just like, you know, like in the old days, people thought the Earth would end and it just fall. No, the universe most probably continues, but we cannot access that reality. That reality to us is unknowable. It's not unknown. It's we cannot know what's beyond our bubble of light. So here you have modern science telling you that there are things about nature, about reality, that cannot be known, right? And that's a very deep, important lesson for us to understand. So let's talk a little bit about something else, about matter, right? So matter, there is a picture there of, it's a self-portrait of Rembrandt, right? The Dutch painter. And usually, you know, if you've seen other of his self-portraits, he's always like kind of looking gloomy and unhappy, right? So that's kind of unusual. He's young there. And the reason why he's happy is because the name of the painting is a self-portrait in the likeness of Democritus. Now, Democritus was the philosopher that about 450 years before Christ developed atomism. So atomism is this notion that matter is made of tiny little bits, and if you cut pieces of stuff to the bottom, you're going to hit these atoms, and you cannot go beyond that. So it's the idea that there is this construction, bottom-up construction from these atoms to everything else. It was a brilliant idea. Their atoms are very different from the modern atoms. You know, our modern atoms are not like that. They're made of protons, neutrons, electrons. They can change and can get stuff out. But the idea that matter is made of little bits remains, right? And the same questions that he was asking that long ago are the same questions that particle physicists that work at the Atlas detector that found the Higgs are asking. What is the world made of, right? Now, the reason why Rembrandt was laughing in this, and it's because Democritus had a nickname as the laughing philosopher. So the reason why he was called the laughing philosopher is because he believed that if you could think critically about the world and not believe in things that superstition or other people would tell you, but if you had the autonomy to think for yourself rationally, you would be a freer person, right? So the path to freedom was not belief, was thinking, right? And he was saying these things all that time ago, and he thought that to be happy was to be free in your mind, and hence that statement, which I think is a really wonderful statement. And though, so we've gone a long way with the nature of matter, and we have this quantum physics that describes the nature of reality, and it creates all sorts of complications to the way we understand the world, because it turns out that when you look at how atoms behave, they behave very differently from ping pong balls. You know, they are not the same thing. In fact, we don't really know exactly how atoms behave. We cannot know exactly how atoms behave because One thing is to see things and to get things and to measure them and to touch them and to experiment with them. And we don't do with atoms. You know, we don't do that with electrons. You don't grab an electron or see an electron. All you do is you collect little clicks in detectors, or you see little paths in detectors. And so from something that is so, so small, right, that we could not see, to something that we can perceive, you have to get that little signal and you have to amplify it a lot, right? And you use all these machines called photomultipliers, etc., to amplify the signal of what a little particle can do to something that we can see. And there's a huge gap between these two realities, what we can see and what the electron is really doing. It turns out then that from the formalism of quantum physics, right, the mathematics that described, you can even talk about an electron existing before you interact with it. You can say it has a potentiality to exist. It may have this energy or that energy. It may be here or it may be there, but you cannot be certain until you interact with it. And that is completely different from the objective way we look at the world in our perspective. Right? You can separate yourself from the chair, from me, and you say, yeah, you know, I'm an objective observer of what's going on. Well, the quantum world, if you cannot do that, if you're giving reality to what you're measuring by the act of measurement, you cannot separate yourself from what's being measured anymore. And that brings up all these amazing and awesome philosophical questions, which I don't have time to talk about, but I do talk about a lot in the book, which is there such a thing as objectivity? Do we determine reality at a very fundamental level? Or is some sort of split between the weird stuff that happens in the quantum world and the way we see the world? I mean, is there some sort of, you know, as you go down in scales, right, to smaller and smaller things, at what point our view of the world breaks down and you have to adopt the quantum view of the world, right? But this relationship between this invisible reality of the quantum is a very, very challenging one. And there is something else that happens there, which is the second unknowable, which is the following. It turns out that the difference between our perspective, the classical perspective, and the quantum perspective is called determinism. It's the idea that you can predict what is going to happen, okay? And it turns out in the quantum world, you cannot predict. You can give a probability of something happening, but you cannot say, this is going to happen. You cannot say, in 2,000 years from now, there's going to be a total solar eclipse, and you can go to Malaysia to watch it. You can do that, because the solar system is so stable, all you have to do is run the equations for 2,000 years in the future, and you're going to get the total eclipse. You could not do that with an electron in an atom. And what happens is that you have this fundamental indeterminacy where things can be, say, rotating this way. You know, everything rotates, right? I mean, we don't, unless you're a whirling dervish. But, you know, everything rotates. And electrons rotate, too. And it turns out that they can rotate clockwise and counterclockwise. Okay, so there's a 50-50% chance that when you see an electron, you may be doing this or that, okay? And it is really interesting that you cannot know until you measure it. You cannot predict that I'm going to see an electron going clockwise or going counterclockwise. And that drove Einstein crazy, right? Because he believed in this fundamental determinacy that you could understand the world at the very foundation of it through reason. And here was quantum physics telling him, sorry. You know, so there's this funny story that he said, you know, God doesn't play dice, meaning it's not 50-50. I have to figure out something here. And another one of the architects of quantum mechanics called Niels Bohr said, Einstein, stop telling God what to do, you know, and accept this fundamental indeterminacy of nature, another unknowable. So at the very core of matter, so we went from the edge of the universe to the very core of matter to find another unknowable. Right? And that has all sorts of implications, including the technology of the future with quantum computers and cryptology and all sorts of interesting things that I can't talk about because I want to use the last few minutes. And I also won't talk about what's in that bottom right there, which is the composition of the universe. That let me just mention that we only know about 5% of the stuff that is out there. So the universe is made of 95% of stuff that that we don't know, okay, which is humbling to say the least, right? So here we are with such advanced science, and we really have these fundamental questions to understand that we still don't. And let me just mention that Democritus mentioned that in reality, we know nothing, right? Because truth is in the depth. So here is the laughing philosopher that says, you know, mind is the way to freedom, but yet be humble to understand that any statement about the truth is qualified, is not final, because we're always evolving. And the reason why I showed you these different visions of what the universe is made of, you know, the 1500s, the 1700s, the modern times, is because it tells you how our cosmic view is changing in time because of the way we look at the world through our instruments, through our theories. So what is the universe? I don't know, but I can tell you what we know now. This is the universe we exist and live in. But is that the final answer? No, it's not the final answer. Maybe I'll ask you guys, what is the final answer? You know, like that movie, that show. So let me just spend a couple of minutes talking about the mind, right? Because after all the stuff that we see and everything that we talk about is really coming from this small mass in our heads, right? And the first thing we have to say is sorry to Descartes, right? And why that? Well, because Descartes was the one that created this notion of dualism, the idea that there is matter and there is soul, right? The idea that there is matter and soul. There is the material and the imponderable, right? And it turns out that the brain does not seem to have a soul in it, right? And the big question we have right now is how can our neurons, so we have about 85 billion neurons, almost like a galaxy in your head, right? So instead of stars, you have neurons flashing, which is kind of a cool image. So, and these neurons, though, they're all networked together. They're like, each one of them have about 1,000 connections to their neighbors, right? And that creates a tremendous amount of possibility, right? So the complexity of the brain is mind-boggling, right? And it turns out that the brain can do about 10 to 18 operations per second. That's what we think. We can't be sure of that, but that's how we estimate. 10 to 18 is a 1 with 18 zeros afterwards, right? So that's about 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 operations per second, or 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 operations per second, right? And computers are not quite there yet. They're about 10 to 16 operations. The fastest computers can do 10 to 16 operations per second. So we're getting there. So the question is, will we be able, with powerful machines, reconstruct the human brain so that the machine can think like we can, right? So tomorrow I'm going to talk at Google in Mountain View, and I have to spend more time there talking about this because I'm going to tease them, and I'm going to tell them, you know what, guys? Sorry, it's much more complicated than that, right? The brain is not just the neurons and the synapses. The brain is a vast network of all these neurotransmitters, serotonin, and all sorts of things flowing through those synaptic gaps. And it is incredibly complex, right? And the complexity, even at the single neuron level, is very big. So will you be able to create a simulation that can make a machine think? Well, I have a picture there of Garry Kasparov, right? The Kasparov, the great chess master, being beaten by the IBM computer. Right? And you say, wow, this machine must be really smart. No, the machine is not intelligent at all. The machine was obeying a set of rules, a program that was designed by programmers. And what the machine can do that we can't is go through all combinatorics, all possible motions in the chessboard much faster, right? And but that doesn't make it intelligent. That makes it efficient. So efficiency and intelligence are not the same thing. Efficiency may help intelligence, but it's not intelligent. Intelligence will happen when the machine can not just obey the rules, but create new rules and create new ideas or new works of art and have this urge to create that I've been talking about all the time here, right? And that's a very different ballgame. So the question behind creating a machine that can think is, why are you you? What makes you unique? Right? I mean, we are all, and this is the miraculous thing, we are all made of the same stuff, right? We are all made of the same proteins, amino acids, and the molecules and the cells, and yet we are so different, right? And yes, there is the genetic variability, But then there is also what's going on inside your mind. So not only you're different from everybody else, but you're also you the next day. You don't wake up not being you. There is a continuity here that goes on. So how does the brain, how does it do that, right? So how do these neurons sort of work together to create the notion of the self, right? Which is so much yours, right? And that is a question that is very much open. And there are philosophers of mind called, I love this, they're called the New Mysterians. I think that is just a super name. So the New Mysterians are a group of very smart people, philosophers of mind, that say that we cannot understand consciousness, that consciousness is unknowable to humans. And the essential idea is that the brain cannot comprehend itself, right? And that goes to the very core of science. You know, the way in science we understand something usually is by isolating what we understand, right? You get out of what you want to study. Oh, I want to study frogs, you know, in Puerto Rico. So you go and you study frogs. Or I want to understand a star. There is the star. But when you are the thing you want to study, it becomes extremely difficult to have an unbiased view of what's going on, right? And so that is one of the problems with the brain. The other one is the notion of subjective experience. So, for example, when I look at a painting, like we all saw that painting by Rembrandt, right? I look at it, you look at it, we are going to react in different ways. And yet we are seeing the exact same thing. So the sensory input is the same. There is the painting. But the way that sensorial input becomes a subjective experience of how you react to the painting is very different. They're not the same thing. And that gap in the structure of how we think and how we understand the nature of the self is huge. And according to these fellows, which I actually agree with, unknowable as well. So you can create simulations that will mimic the brain. And in fact, the biggest grant ever given in history was given in Europe now, 1 billion euros for the Human Brain Project, which is this vast computer simulation that wants to simulate the brain in every possible detail so that they can recreate the human brain in a machine, right? And I think that that project is basically doomed to fail. You know, they will create something. Maybe they'll create some kind of mind, you know, but I doubt it very much that it could be called a human mind. It would be some other kind of mind, which creates a whole different kind of questions, right? Which is, what if you create a mind eventually in the future, and this is like a scenario, that is smarter than we are, you know? And just like we are smarter than gorillas, and look how the fate of the gorillas depend on us. Right? We could kill all the gorillas right now with machine guns, right, if we wanted to, but we don't because we have, well, it's a bad story with the gorillas, but we still have some morals, right? So the question is, if these machines become super intelligent and think of us as superfluous, what would they do to us? You know. So are we designing our own doom? Or are we designing our future? Are we going to become hybrid with these machines? So these are questions at the cutting edge of mind science, right? And one of them, which I really don't have time to talk about, is this one, which is going back to the Matrix, the notion that, are we living in a simulation? You may say, that's ridiculous. Right? I mean, how could it possibly be in a part of a computer simulation? Well, it's less ridiculous than you think when you start to think about it, because sensorial input could be fed into you and create reality directly into your brain, right? And I don't know if you know a video game called The Sims, Sims for simulation, which is you have a bunch of little characters, you have to take care of them, take them to school, and take the baby to the doctor and stuff. And if you don't, you know, the chaos starts. And so, anyway, girls like, obviously, the game more than boys in general, you know. But the point of the game is that those characters are not autonomous, right? They're just like stuff you control. Now, fast forward 100 years, and you have The Sims version 2003, you know, where the characters are so advanced and so realistic that they believe they are real, that they are autonomous, that they do things without a master puppeteer doing it for them, right? And so they would think that they are as real as we are without knowing there is a master puppeteer out there controlling your motions, right? So this ties up with the whole notion of free will, etc., which is another story. Anyways, so what is the vision of the island of knowledge? Well, essentially, the island of knowledge is where knowledge is, and it grows as time goes by, right? We know more of the world, for sure, right? But sometimes it shrinks when we have an idea that is wrong, that happens. But on average, it's growing. And as every good island, it's surrounded by an ocean. The ocean here is the ocean of the unknown, what we do not know, right? And there are two visions here. One is that, you know, as the island of knowledge grows, this ocean of the unknown is going to become smaller and smaller, and eventually we'll get to the end of knowledge. It will be it, right? And that, to me, is a real sad way to think about the future. Because, and it's wrong. It's sad and wrong, which is good. It's wrong. So the better way to think about it is the following. The island of knowledge grows into this ocean of the unknown, and the boundary is our shores of our ignorance, which basically means that as the island grows, the shores also grow, because it exposes us to new ways of thinking that we could not have predicted before. Case in point, the microscope. Just think how that single invention transformed the way you think about life, or the telescope. So as we know more, we are more equipped to ask questions we couldn't have contemplated before. So knowledge is an endless pursuit. There is no end to knowing because of the myopic aspect of things. Instruments can reach farther out, can have higher precision, but they'll never see everything. There is always going to be a little obscurity out there. So we are always going to be surrounded by mystery. Einstein is right. And we have to embrace that as the way we acquire more knowledge of the world. So this is the picture, you know. You have the island there, the knowledge grows. There is the ocean of the unknown. There are a bunch of unknowables out there, which should bring a lot of humility to people, right? And so the way to think about that is that limits are not obstacles. They're triggers to our imagination, right? That what really matters, what makes us matter, is to want to know. That's really where it is, you know. So it is searching for those answers that makes us matter and understand the world in better ways. So another final metaphor here. Imagine you're a mountain climber, right? And you prepare yourself, you study, you know what you're doing, you're going to tackle that really high mountain, is a major challenge. And so you go up there and you go, yes, I reached the peak, that's it. So there are two things you can do. The first one is that I reached the peak, that's it, I'm going to go down and move on with my life, right? Or you reach the peak, you look around, and you say, hey, look at that. There are all these higher mountains out there for me to go for. And you go again, and you keep climbing. And when you find the highest of all of them, you go to space. There is no end to it. And that's how we should think about it. So reality really is an ever-shifting mosaic of ideas. And that's how really we understand truth in a very provisional way, at least when it comes to these very deep questions. And that's what makes science human, fallible and powerful at the same time. Thank you.
So I'd like to remind our audience that they're listening to Professor Marcelo Gleiser of Dartmouth College speaking about the island of knowledge. We have time for a couple questions.
It's on.
You heard that the mind is in the brain. Now, I don't think that that's established. And the brain is a receptor. No more than that. So we are picking up in our imaginations information from someplace else. I think that's what you're talking about. What is that source? We are limited by our imagination, which are kind of set when we're little kids, and limit our ability to maximize the use of the brain. But we still don't know where the mind is. The brain is just a computer, as I understand it. Would you discuss that a little bit?
Sure. I think that the mind is in the brain, or is engendered by the brain. We don't know how, but that doesn't mean it's not there. So sometimes not knowing an answer doesn't mean we have to search it in obscure ways. It means we have to search harder, you know. And I think, yes, the mind, as I said, is a real hard, difficult question. What is the mind? Where? How can the neurons do that? But I don't think finding an answer in some obscure formula will help us understand anything. So I think that the challenge is to, okay, how does the mind emerge in our brains, you know, before we start looking for answers outside of our heads, which we may never understand at all. And the other thing to say is about imagination. I don't think so. I think we're creative all our lives, you know, and all we have to do is to make sure those ports are open, you know. That's essentially the idea. So as long as you find meaning in your life, I think your creativity will come with it. So I think we are always, should always be very creative. They even say that, you know, philosophers are always better when they're older. So they're still being creative, which I like. Thank you.
Hi, thanks very much. I really enjoyed the talk. One of the things I struggle with when I listen to talks like this is some of the criteria cited, such as, you know, the universe being 13.8 billion years old, the distance between galaxies, and even things at the very small scale, those criteria are not fundamental. We say the universe is 13.8 billion years old because that's how it appears to us. If you were a photon that left the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago from our reference frame, all the events in the universe would have unraveled in an instant. From that perspective, and distance likewise is not a fundamental principle, not a fundamental quality of the universe. Do you think we'll ever be able to get outside of time and space and look at it from an outside perspective to really understand how it is?
I don't know. Nobody knows that, the answer to that. I think that, you know, in science we have to organize knowledge and present it in ways that everybody can understand. I mean, science is a very universal language. It doesn't matter if you're a Muslim, if you're a Jew, if you live in here or if you live in Patagonia, the equations and the way we describe the age of the universe or what is a photon, they're the same. So there is a very universal language that we try to establish. And because of that, we have to have certain criteria. It's just like when a language has grammar rules. In science, we have ways to describe distance and time, and that's how we make sense of things. That doesn't mean that we can't change perspective. So what you mentioned about the photon, that's what we scientists call a change of reference frame. And we do that all the time. But the notion of getting out of space and time, our minds are wonderful, right? Because they can do things that we can't, like physically, right? But our imagination can. And in a sense, we're trying to do that all the time. We're always trying to beat space and time in different ways, you know, through your equations, through your music, through your novels. You know, people talk about the stream of consciousness, you know, the idea of... So I would say to you that scientifically, it's very hard to understand the world without space and without time, because space is where things happen and time is when things happen, and it's very difficult to describe reality without these two tools. The tough question, though, is, are these two tools just tools, or are they really the frame of reality? I mean, is space and time just some invention, or are they really part of the universe in a very deep sense? And nobody yet knows the answer to that question. Thanks.
Thank you. Fascinating information.
Thanks.
I had a question about, you mentioned a couple things in the beginning of your talk, one about Plato and his book about training new leaders, and also not discrediting what's been done in the past and, you know, our seekers and new innovations and systems. So I'm always questioning, you know, what are the new systems that we can design? And at the time when the economic system was developed and everything, it was what we designed because what would work at that time. So my question is, how are you getting this information, which is so valuable, into the hands of our current leaders, and then the potentiality of new leaders, and, you know, what they can potentially do with this information to to train new leaders and birth new leaders for right. new systems?
That's a great question. It's funny. Yesterday, I gave a talk at Caltech, and somebody asked me exactly the same question. Uh-huh. It was actually the last question of the day. And what I personally do is this.
Right.
And write my books, and I write for NPR, which has a big, you know, I have a blog on science and culture at NPR. So that has a big, and I also, most importantly, is I visit schools. I go talk to kids about science. And that is something that scientists here don't do enough.
Absolutely.
Everybody's so busy, you know, in their labs and with their classes and stuff, they don't take 2 hours of their time to go to a public school and talk to sixth graders, eighth graders about the universe. When you do, it's just awesome. The kids are like big-eyed like this, you know, about the universe and black holes, and we inflate the speech so that they're like, wow, you know, kind of thing. And they love it. But most kids, and certainly the kids that become political leaders afterwards, never really heard of scientists in their lives, you know, or very little. And that is a problem. So one of the things that could be done is that scientists should be less lazy and more proactive in promoting scientific knowledge than we do.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Professor, for an excellent talk. And we will end this event with exactly the same question. So thank you very much for coming, everybody. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 112th year of enlightened discussion.
Thank you.
And Professor Gleiser will be signing his book. If anyone would like to buy it, he'll be right out here in just a minute or so.
Thank you.